From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and I'm Anmarai Roque sitting in for Sandy Billings today. Today I'm bringing you a show about giving. Our first installment comes from Jessica Behrman. She's the researcher and author of Giving Together, a national scan of giving circles and shared giving. And the follow-up title, More Giving Together, the growth and impact of giving circles and shared giving. Behrman is lead consultant to Project Streamline, an effort to help grant makers minimize the burden of application and reporting on the nonprofit sector, and is the researcher and author of Drowning in Paperwork, Distracted from Purpose. One of her specialties is giving circles. Giving circles are where a number of people come together and give a certain amount, say $1,000 a year, and then the funds are pooled together and they give them away. Usually the donors themselves set criteria for giving the pooled gifts to community causes. Giving circles let relatively small gifts make a big impact on a community. Jessica Behrman was instrumental in establishing a women's giving circle right here in Moscow, Idaho. This year, the circle gave more than $19,000 to Moscow charities. Earlier this year, Jessica Behrman joined three other women to talk about giving to the community. The event, hosted by Moscow Civic Association, highlighted the important work of non-commercial sector of the community, including government service, nonprofit work, and associations. This installment are excerpts from that event.
I have never thought of myself as an activist. I always thought to be an activist, you needed to have certain particular skills and interests and experiences. And I think what I've learned, and I think this is probably going to resonate, is that, you know, you bring what you have, and what you have is enough. And then you find the other things that you need. So with the Giving Circle, you know, I've been studying philanthropy for many years, particularly how do you grow philanthropic resources in a community? And I've been studying Giving Circles, and they're just fascinating. We've located, you know, more than 500 around the country.
Wow.
Of all shapes and sizes, and I think that's probably just the tip of the iceberg, because most giving circles, which are just groups of people who pool their money and then figure out how to give it away, you know, most of them just exist around people's kitchen tables or in their living rooms, although some of them grow very large. So when I moved to Moscow, I came with a pretty deep knowledge of this phenomena, and I thought, well, you know, I hope there's a giving circle there. This was about 3 years ago. I hope there's a giving circle in Moscow, because I'm ready to join one. You know, I feel like I've reached a point in my life where I could do that. And there wasn't a giving circle that I could find. If there was one, it was hidden in someone's dining room. And so I was always running. I was running in the mornings with friends. And, you know, we're doing these long runs, and there's a lot of time to chat and get to know people on long runs. And I was talking about giving circles and how great they were and how fabulous it would be if we could start one. And finally someone said, fine, we can start a giving circle. And it was really that easy. I took my sort of book knowledge of the way giving circles work, and we mapped out a plan for how one might start in Moscow, and then we planned a party, which a lot of us are good at, I think, and it was just a party in Kathy Bierman's backyard, and 50 women came, and about half of them wrote checks on the spot. So it turned out to be an idea that just really had legs. It was an idea that immediately made sense to people and resonated, that you could have a bigger impact by pooling your money and giving away larger chunks of it at a time. I'm going to stop there.
Well, to me, it seems like one way to sum this up is that you follow your passion.
Arlene Falcon, business owner, activist, a KRFP founder, and HempFest organizer, was also on the panel. She was representing Buy Local Moscow.
That's how that seed starts, is that you're excited about something, and because you're passionate about it, you can follow through, and all of a sudden it's not work, and it's something that really makes sense, and you're there. And it just seems like, from listening to what we're all saying, that's what's driven us. What are the mechanics of making it all happen once you have this idea? Once you have this idea, there's so many different things you have to deal with.
I think one of the things that's interesting is that you have this idea, you're all inspired, you get other people who actually think the idea is a good one, and wow, okay, you know, here we go.
Amy Gray, founder of Backyard Harvest.
There's an enthusiasm and a newness to that, and you're not thinking about liability insurance, and you're not thinking about the IRS 501c3 application and the $750 for that, and you're not, I mean, all the things that go into running a larger nonprofit as you mature. What I think is hard, what I think the danger is not being ground down by all the realities of what it takes. Volunteerism. Great, we got volunteers that are going out. Okay, they're climbing up on 7-foot ladders. I have to have liability insurance. We have to have board insurance, because if someone falls off a ladder, regardless of what we have them sign, right? Even if we have really, you know, you're signing your life away, it's not going to hold up in court. So I've got to make sure that I can't ask people to serve on my board unless I know that the worst thing that can happen is Backyard Harvest Incorporated will go down, but we won't go into anyone's sort of personal finance. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you know, there's that sort of danger that by being, you know, socially conscious and wanting to participate. So suddenly, the thing that you started because you grew too much lettuce and because you got people up is like running a business, and you're suddenly having to become much more conservative or thoughtful about what are the implications of what I'm asking people to do and how I move through. And I think, you know, the key now for us where we're at as an is how do we keep that enthusiasm going in sort of the face of the reality of what it means to run a nonprofit.
And now we're back with Jessica Bierman of the Moscow Giving Circle.
I did want to talk just quickly about sort of the mechanics of getting a really grassroots group going and sustained. And I think the sustained part is hard, because with a lot of these other efforts, at some point someone's going to get paid. But with something like a giving circle, you're always asking people to be volunteering both their time and their energy and also their dollars. And year after year, you're saying, again, we'd like you to make your donation of money and into this pooled resource, and your donation of time to help think about who's going to get the money, and how we're going to distribute these funds in the community. And a couple of things that I thought were very helpful. One was, initially we created a small group who made a lot of the initial decisions. We realized that we had hopes of having 30 women involved in this giving circle, and we realized that having 30 women, and as it happened, there were closer to 50 sitting around making decisions about some of these things, would be a recipe for immediate burnout for all concerned. So we decided, we looked at the sort of the host of decisions that would need to be made, and we decided that the bulk of them would really be made by a much smaller sort of founding group. And one of the things that I did that I was very proud of is I recruited Amy Gray to be part of that founding group. If you can recruit a graphic designer to be part of the founding group, it's a really good idea, because immediately everything looks real. So it goes from being, you know, just an idea to being something that has an identity. And I think naming your project and giving it an identity, branding it, you know, to use sort of fancy business speak, is really key, because then people have something that they can get a handle on. And they can think about the fact that they're going to belong to this thing that exists, that has a name, that has an identity. I thought that was really important for the circle. So the small group made a lot of the initial decisions about things like, you know, how much are we going to ask people to donate each year? $365, as it turned out. What are going to be our focus areas for grant making? You know, sort of broadly defined. How many people? Do we want men and women, or just women? Are we going to let people give less and still vote? No. So we made a lot of those initial decisions in a much smaller group where it didn't entail hours and hours of dialogue. But then we expanded the group, and we made sure that there were still decisions that could be made by the expanded group, and also that there were going to be additional avenues for participation and decision making for other people as they became involved. Because I think if you recruit people to something and you ask them to belong and really invest in it, both their time and their money, you need to give them a stake, and you know, not only can the entity really benefit from their expertise and their wisdom and their thoughtfulness, but they're not going to stick around, chances are, if they never get to make any decisions. So there are still ongoing a number of decisions that the whole group makes, or at other sort of categories, subgroups of people make. So every year there's a grant-making committee, self-selected from among the group. This year I think there are 12 or 13 people on it, and it's that group that really makes the decisions about each year's grant cycle. What's the specific priority area this year? How are we going to get the word out? What's the request for proposals going to look like? How are we going to narrow, you know, a pool of perhaps 30 applicants down to a finalist pool of 10? So I guess my bottom line is just be sure that you think about the range of decisions that need to be made and figure out sort of in advance, to the extent that you can, who is going to be responsible for making them, and make sure that everyone's got a chance to make decisions that are sort of reasonable for them to make.
Nancy Cheney, Mayor of Moscow.
I think Jessica makes some excellent points about the need for structure and some predictability, some opportunity for buy-in. This whole concept of collaborative energy and the partnerships and networking that go into making these things function.
In terms of collaboration and partnerships, I mean, the Giving Circle's got a couple of things going on, again, that are sort of more grassrootsy, but the one that's quite official is that we had to decide how we were going to give away money. We needed some sort of a nonprofit umbrella to allow us to accept donations that were tax deductible. And so we thought about whether we wanted to become our own nonprofit organization. And then we realized that Moscow, actually Latah County, has a community foundation, which many of you probably did know. But not everyone knows that Latah County has a community foundation. It's a small grant-making entity, and it is, you know, a 501c3 grant-making entity, so it could serve our purposes. And so instead of going out and becoming our own nonprofit, we asked them if we could sort of use them as our umbrella organization, as our fiscal sponsor, and they said, oh, can we do that? We said, yeah, you can do that. So they did it. And it's great. It's a great collaboration for both groups, because for our purposes it means we don't have to deal with a lot of administrative stuff that we would have had to deal with. And it means that we have the credibility of being partnered with a long-standing entity in the community. And from their perspective, it increases the amount of money that goes out the door under their auspices in grants by about 50%. So it's really a win-win type of collaboration. I am up next to kick off the next topic, which is just reality versus vision. Once your project, your inspiration becomes a real thing and has legs and has partners and has volunteers, what are some of the lessons that you learn? What are some of the challenges that you encounter, things to avoid? And then we're also going to share whatever advice we might have for you in your own ventures. So I'm going to be very quick. I mean, just a couple of short things that I think will be really self-evident in a lot of ways. The first is that, you know, you should just try. You should ask. This is a really old sort of fundraising fact, I guess, which is that
people will do what you ask them to do, largely. They will give if you ask them to give. They'll participate if you ask them to participate. And so the first lesson that I learned was really just ask. And it was hard for me because asking people to donate $365 or more to something, it feels like a big chunk of money for a lot of people. And what I was gratified to learn is that if I asked and explained, many of the people that I asked if they were capable said, yeah, I'd love to do that, and they wrote a check. I had no idea it would be so easy. So try and ask. Another sort of lesson that I think is important is that whatever you're doing, it's going to take more time. It's going to take a lot more time of your time than you think. It's amazing how things grow. And even the communication and things like that Arlene was talking about at the beginning, you know, those things just take a lot more time than you imagine. So build in that time and be patient. Don't expect everything to happen at once. My third sort of lesson for me is watch out for death by opportunity. And this is, I think, a little bit of what Amy was just talking about. When you've got something going and it's attracting a lot of excitement and interest and people want to be invested in it and buy into it, they're all going to come with their ideas. And that's great. You want their ideas. But if you are not clear about what you're trying to accomplish and you allow these various ideas, this influx of ideas to pull you this way and that, then your precious energy and your resources are going to get frayed and your project as a whole is going to lose momentum. So I think it is really important to focus, to do that sort of mission development and figuring out what your vision is and figuring out when each new opportunity presents itself, to what extent is it, you know, going to move you forward or is it going to sort of pull you to the side? So watch out for death by opportunity. And then finally, and this is a little bit almost counter to what I just said, but it's also critical, build in a way to grow new leadership and don't hold on too tightly yourself. You know, as a founder of something, I think it's really easy to believe that your vision is the vision and your way is the way. Particularly if you're a type A type, like some of us at this table, you might think that nobody else can do it quite as well. But you are not going to last. And so certainly for me, what I'm most excited about right now with the Giving Circle is that there are people who are saying, you know what, I'll run the grant making process this year. And lo and behold, they're doing it. They're sending out the emails that I would otherwise be sending out. You know, they are figuring out what worked well last year and what didn't and making revisions. They're doing it better than I could. So I think letting go a little, as long as it's mission aligned, and building those opportunities for new people to step in and become leaders is critical to your own sanity and also to the health of your endeavor.
Well, I'm pulling off what Jessica said, what you
Backyard
do
Harvest,
in your first
Amy
year
Gray.
Starting a project is not what you should be doing your third or fourth year. I've picked a lot of fruit, I've gleaned a lot of vegetables, but this year, in order for Backyard Harvest to survive and prosper and move forward, I've got to be fundraising and being on top of grants and seeing new opportunities to collaborate and move and doing media. But my job no longer is climbing up those ladders. And that doesn't mean I won't do it in a pinch, because I absolutely will. But it just means that what the organization needs from you may change. I'm still a little shy about asking for money, so I won't do that, even though Jessica will hit me. But I will ask for fruits or veggies. I'm very forward about that. So Backyard Harvest.
Check for $50.
Oh, shh. If you have a fruit tree, come, and that's dropping its fruit, you can come talk to me. If you want to plant an extra row in your vegetable garden, I can set you up with compost and starts and seeds in the springtime. If you want to come out, we have big gleaning events and small gleaning events. You don't need to climb up on ladders.
I get to do pitches?
Again, Arlene Falcon,
well,
owner of Tie Dye Everything.
Hats. So I guess I'll do the buy local one first, and that is to remind everyone how important it is to support our local businesses, because it keeps our economy sustainable and local, and it employs people locally, it supports our local residents, it's helping each other, and that's why buy local is such a positive thing. The thing I want to stress about buy local, though, it's not just downtown businesses, it's all of the service people in the community. And check out buylocalmoscow.com. It's a wonderful website, and it's an awesome resource for a lot of great things for all the lawyers that you might be interested, or the massage people who have enlisted and become part of this organization. There are about 80 paying members. And then one more thing, I have Lee sitting right here. He is our program director of our local radio station, KRFP, Radio Free Moscow. We're 4 years old.
4 years on the air.
4 years on the air. 7 years as an organization. It took 3 years to where we could get on the air, and we are a totally volunteer run, except for Lee, who works his butt off. volunteer organization. And once again, if you have a passion for anything, it's a wonderful voice because you can have an hour or a 2 hour weekly radio show and it's all volunteer run. And it's great that it's so community supported because we do have a great array of different shows, talk shows, music shows, news shows, and it's all locally done. It's Radio Free Moscow 92.5.
Arlene makes some excellent points.
Moscow Mayor Nancy Cheney with a wrap-up.
Variety, the cultural flavor we have here in Moscow, and a lot of that is because of the citizen engagement here. So this is just an outstanding opportunity to become more involved. And the other point she made was it feels good to do this. I think everybody up here finds enjoyment. However hard the work might be, however challenging some days might be, there is real joy and fulfillment in trying to make a positive difference in one's community.
In life, when you're looking for one thing, you might find something totally unexpected. Sandy Billings brings us this next installment about a mom who started a new charity by accident while working on a garden project with her children.
Charity can start by accident. In Amy Gray's case, it started with
The lettuce incident, we can call it.
The lettuce incident. What will now be called the lettuce incident resulted in a burgeoning not-for-profit operation called Backyard Harvest. It started in Moscow, Idaho, and it's now operating in 6 cities and 3 states, Idaho, Washington, and California. Backyard Harvest is about providing food, fresh produce, a rare and needed commodity, to local food banks. It works like this. If you grow produce in your garden that you can't use for any reason, perhaps because you planted too much of one thing or because you're heading out of town, you can bring it to Backyard Harvest or you can give them a call and they'll collect it and they'll get it to a food bank in your community. It's as simple as that. But for Amy, it's now a full-time, non-paying job. It's a labor of love. And she runs a nonprofit organization. And it all started because Amy Gray was looking for a project to do with her kids.
I never set out to start a nonprofit. I never set out to collect 38,000 pounds of produce. I was a beginning gardener, and I was kind of a frazzled mother, and I had 2 young sons. And we moved to a new house. They were into planting lettuce seeds. I wasn't going to stop them. And one thing led to another, and you know, as any sort of experienced gardener will tell you, you don't plant them all at once. You plant a few each week so that you have lettuce all summer long rather than 200 heads of lettuce all together. And I suddenly had this huge crop of lettuce. We have friends, but we don't have that many friends. And so I started calling the food banks. Would you take lettuce? I got lettuce. And they were responsive to it. They said yes. So for the rest of that summer, it was just a simple individual act. I just thought, well, if they like that, the kids like planting, we'll just plant entire packets of lots of veggies and just give them to the food bank. That's, you know, we'll take what we need for our family and we'll move forward. In looking back on it 3 years later, that single act, we all do things like this all the time in our community, whether it's putting a bench out and creating a bus stop because you see, you know, an elderly person who's sitting there waiting for the bus, you know, or standing waiting for the bus. Or it's shoveling someone's walk, your next door neighbor's walk, because it's snowing and that's an easy thing to do. So those acts happen all the time. I think what the difference was for getting Backyard Harvest off the ground was that I accidentally grew these 200 heads of lettuce in a community with a vibrant local food network and scene. And that was my good fortune, because what I did was is I began to tell people about, well, you know, I have this lettuce, and did you know that the food banks actually take things other than cans? And I let the news out, and I started asking people, and just sort of talking about this idea. And so it began to percolate, and I'm a designer, so the skill set that I brought to it was, okay, I'm going to think about a name and a logo and an idea for a refrigerator magnet. I thought, what if other gardeners have to have the same problem. What if we had a magnet they could stick on the refrigerator and someone to call, and we could do a door-to-door pickup service? Now, at that point, was I ready to start a nonprofit? Absolutely not. I mean, you know, but I talked to enough people who put me in touch with Tom Lamar at PCI.
Amy's talking about the Palouse Clearwater Environmental Institute, a well-known local environmental organization. The director, Tom Lamar, was one of many community members who came on board to turn Amy's idea into a movement.
The community itself was sheltering and was going to help this idea grow beyond what I was going to be able to do. Tom said, yeah, let's pilot it. We have a pantry garden. We could try this out. And so then I was, you know, being sheltered by a large, that idea was being nurtured. Since then, at every different step, the thing that I brought to Backyard Harvest was the idea and that first idea of doing produce pickups. All our other programs have come from the community. It's been people within the community that have said, you know, I have a fruit tree. Would you be willing to get up on a ladder? Okay. So now we have Town Orchard and we have 300 trees registered. Again, that was an idea that came out of the community. We're doing Shop the Market now. We're allowing low-income families to use their food stamps at the market. That was a UI graduate student who had heard about a program in another community who came in, and Kathleen Burns, who said, look, we really need to do this. Will you partner with us? So the idea that we all have good ideas, how can we connect them and find a community of people who are willing to work on that idea with you? And then suddenly it becomes much less about me. I mean, we always, the 200 heads of lettuce story always sort of, you know, reporters and stuff want to go back to that. But today, Backyard Harvest is so much not about that initial accident that got it started, and so much more about a community sort of realizing that everyone can do small parts to make a big impact.
Many people came together to make Backyard Harvest happen. And kind of by accident, their efforts turned into a movement.
You can learn more about Backyard Harvest at www.backyardharvest.org. This third installment is an interview with Beth Harrod, a Boise woman and civic leader. Beth experienced culture shock when she and her husband moved to small-town Boise in the 1970s, after living in various big cities around the country. She found herself not working, a stay-at-home mom with two kids. So Beth sought challenges outside the house and became a volunteer and civic leader. She talks with Sandy about giving her time as a volunteer at several organizations. Some of her volunteer roles include being a member of the Boise School Board for 18 years, working with the State Board of Idaho Charitable Trust Fund, the Women's and Children's Alliance, the Boise Art Museum, and the Idaho Botanical Gardens.
I'm speaking with Bev Harrod of Boise, and she's a consummate volunteer, working for her community through a number of nonprofit and civic organizations. So thanks for speaking with me today, Bev.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I would like to start by talking just a little bit about the numerous roles that you've filled as a volunteer, and noting, of course, that just before this phone call, you were interviewing a candidate for a nonprofit executive position, if I understand correctly.
Indeed.
Yeah, that shows just how much impact a volunteer can have.
Absolutely.
So what other kinds of roles do or have you filled as a volunteer?
You know, Sandy, I think I kind of started at the very bottom when I first moved to Boise, and that was basically joining several organizations where I call the cookie and coffee role, just doing whatever needed to be done. And from that, I learned how volunteerism worked, and it was very quick. I was very quick to kind of climb the volunteer ladder, and partly because Boise was so much smaller than they really valued volunteer help. So I quickly went on to boards in the city. I was on the art museum board, on the Beaux Arts Board, which was the volunteer arm of the art museum, on the Idaho Botanical Board, on the Philharmonic Board, at least a dozen. And from that, I learned a lot of skills. I learned organizational skills. I learned human resource skills that I hadn't learned in my job. And one thing led to another. In the early 80s, when there was a terrible budget deficit in the legislature, which isn't interesting how history repeats itself, and the legislature was threatening to cut monies going to the public schools, a friend of mine and I organized a statewide lobbying network of parents to prompt the legislature to continue to give a reasonable amount of funding for schools. And so that was a kind of an entree into the political arena. From that, I went on to run for Boise School Board, and I ran three successive terms and served 18 years on the board. And as I continue to participate on boards and on some state boards, I've also, through volunteerism, have branched out into independent activities, if you will. I very often will go into nonprofits and help them do focus groups, help them with their strategic planning, look at their model for fund development, how valid is it. I've served on search committees for their executive directors. So it really has run its gamut, and it's been quite satisfying.
I would assume that it's satisfying because you're doing so much of it. And I want to talk about the satisfaction side, but first of all, I kind of understand the background here. You were working and you then moved to volunteering full time, or how did that work? Because the activity you're describing is so much. How do you do a job and that?
Oh, well, when we first moved to Idaho in 1976, and I kind of went through culture shock. I mean, we moved to Idaho from Philadelphia to Boston to Cambridge to San Francisco and then to Idaho. And I woke up one morning and went, oh my gosh, I went looking for bagels and there weren't any bagels in Boise, Idaho, and I realized I was in a different part of the world.
Yes, in Boise now.
Yeah. I mean, it was like 65,000 at that point, and I realized I needed to. I wasn't working at the time. Both of my children were 4 and 6, so I was a full-time mom at the time. I realized I needed to learn a new way of life so that I could feel that I was being valued and contributing and feeling challenged. So that's how that all happened. During volunteerism over the years, I worked intermittently. I was a partner, and we had a little interior design shop. At one point, we had been involved as investors in a restaurant, and there were some changes in the administration team, and I had to run the restaurant for a year. My work experience was very spotty over the years. And you know what? That's the lovely thing about volunteerism. You make it work for your life. And it works.
Explain what you mean by that. Make it work for your life, fit it in when you can is part of
that is? Exactly. I mean, anyone who volunteers will say to you, I think they'll say, oh my gosh, I'm just in knee deep. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how I ever got to this point. Well, you know what? That's probably true. But on the same token, because you as a volunteer are in control of your choices, and you, when you accept a responsibility for a board or to chair a certain project, you have the ability to quantify how many hours that's going to be of your time. And you know how much time you have outside of your home and your family and your job.
Yeah. I think you may have hit the nail on the head. Some volunteers, though, and some workers, some people, don't know when to say no. I'm sure I err on that side.
Well, you know what? It's true. And I think that comes with... I'm not going to say it comes with age. I'm not going to say that. But you know what? It partly really does, because you get to a point where you say, you know, I need to sit back here and decide where I can be of value and something can be of value to me. I can't spread myself too thin. It happens.
Well, and that aspect of it being of value to me too is part of that. What do I get out of it, and why do people volunteer in the first place?
Exactly.
So what are some of the things that you get out of it?
I think the first thing that most in fact, I think one of the first things that promotes volunteerism amongst women especially is the ability to meet different people and to be able to create a very productive, positive network of relationships. I think after a while that there's more of a comfort level there, and then you kind of go up to the next level. It could be any number of things, and I think it depends on what type of volunteer activity a person is involved in. But for myself, I have always tried to choose, and it's been lovely that I've had options in terms of what I can choose and what I choose not to choose. These are activities, one, in which I learn and I can grow intellectually. Two, that a place where I have a passion and I feel that I can be effective in making a change. And as I've gotten older, that third one is extraordinarily important to me. I really don't choose any volunteerism anymore where I'm just taking up space. I need to feel effective. I've learned, as I mentioned before, I've learned strategic planning skills. I've learned better human resource skills. So I think those are some of the primary reasons.
And related to the passion, I'm assuming there's a good warm, fuzzy feeling that comes from the success of the organization and the task you've taken on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that goes without doubt. And that's the lovely thing about volunteerism, where, you know, if you're working in a paying job, you know, ideally you'd like to think everyone is being rewarded with warm, fuzzy feelings because they love what they're doing, but you and I both know that's not necessarily the case all the time. With volunteerism, it should be the case, once again, because you're in charge. You're in control.
Yeah, that's very impressive. Now, you can't do this without big family support, and by having kids at home at the right time and a husband working, you had the ability to spend your time. Actually, it sounds like you had the need to go out and get out of the house and and get involved. But you continued having that ability. So you have to have that family support to do it at the level you're doing. Even if you're working, I don't mean to imply that not working changes that. Because it takes time away from the family and it lets the family contribute in some ways. Do you see it that way?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, for me and as a woman, my family, my children and my husband were very important, and nothing interfered with that. Although I can say that in practicality there were probably lots of times when there was some interference, but hopefully nothing to a great degree. No, you need to have the support. But you know, I will tell you that many times over the years, my husband was there helping me. And there were many times over the years when my children were just in grade school, and I was chairing the Christmas sale for the art museum or art in the park. They were there with me doing little things. And you know what? It was a good experience for them. So I guess the motto here is, the moral of the story rather is that there are times when you can integrate your volunteerism into your family life in a very productive way.
Well, thank you for all your work to make Boise and Idaho a better place to live. And
you're welcome.
Thanks for sharing some of your insights with us today.
Thank you, Sandy. It was a pleasure. Good luck with your show.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye bye.
In this next installment, Kay Keskinen talks about her feminist mother and nurturer, Virginia Ginny Wolf. Wolf was a professor of physical education at the University of Idaho, and she dedicated her entire life to the well-being of women, physically, socially, and politically. She married her profession, gave her salary to the National Organization of Women, known as NOW, and exerted her energy to women's rights.
Very brave woman. When people, there was the movie, probably the book, sorry, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I knew Ginny's reputation before I knew her. She was a feared feminist. When she came to the door of a department or whatever, you knew you were in trouble and you better tidy up your act. Ginny became my feminist mother, my feminist nurturer. I met her on January 27th, 1975. And that was the evening of a meeting where the Moscow NOW chapter formed. Ginny formed the NOW chapter. She was the convener, and that was just very exciting. We had a very active chapter. The chapter still exists, even to this day. The chapter was special in many ways. It included people in town, people out of town, city, campus people, non-campus people, men and women, a variety of ages. And Ginny had that ability to bring people together from all sorts of backgrounds and help make change. And that was just very exciting to be a baby feminist and to have someone like that. Ginny was a great nurturer. She had a sense of when it was time for someone to take a next step in terms of doing something. You might have helped with a committee or done something, and she could just sort of look at you and say, I think it's time for you to help put out that newsletter, you know, or whatever she could, you know, she had the ability to see where your interests were and your skills and just stretch you enough a little bit to do some things. And so Ginny, you know, Ginny's biggest influence, I think, was the political change. She had a price to pay for that. She had a difficult time getting tenure and took a complaint, and I did not know her well at that time, so then she wasn't sharing. And she was also a pretty private person. She didn't share a lot of that stuff about herself. But very public in terms of her support. I mean, she was a feminist, and she grew up, I think, in a background. She grew up at a time when there weren't many opportunities for women. She was born in 1924. In fact, things weren't very equal at that time. Her brothers would get the summer jobs. I think she would talk about her brothers would get summer jobs mowing lawns and doing this, and the girls weren't given those type of opportunities. But she always made sure the opportunities were there for others. She wasn't much of a cook, but we always had butted. So we'd have a lot of potlucks at her house. And one time she had invited the state senator, Norma Doblar, to be her dinner guest one time, and she forgot to turn on the oven. Just the kind of things. But she did teach me how to make a real nice martini or something. I'd be her drink fixer or something like that. She had a pool table in the basement, and so we would shoot pool for the ERA. And so the door would stick. I remember the lower door when you came into her house would stick. That got you into the living room. It was a split-level house. And so it would say something like, push hard for the ERA. And so you'd push me there. And then we'd shove a lot of pull from the ERA. There'd be money on the table. There's always an excuse to put some money for something in the Equal Rights Amendment. Moved away in 1982, and it said there she moved to Port Townsend. She and another friend had taken a drive around trying to figure out where the best places for feminists to be, and I actually did visit her on Port Townsend, and it was very, very nice place, right on the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and all the ships that went into the Seattle Harbor came by her house, so she had these big picture windows with binoculars, so as the ships came by, you would go look at that. Once basketball season started, we'd be on the phone probably at least once a week, twice a week, calling after the games. We both followed Stanford. She and I went to two Western Regional basketball tournaments and one National Final Four. Just a chance for us to get back. The last time I'd seen her was at a regional in Spokane at WSU High School. So a mentor she was. She taught me a lot about mentoring, you know, how you can directly mentor someone or indirectly. She was also very anonymous in terms of making sure that there was money available for people. They may not have known it came from Ginny, but if somebody needed money for some transportation or a conference fee or some sort of thing, she'd make sure the money was available. And that was just, you know, she put her money where her beliefs were. And while I was still at UI, and even after I retired, I would still call Ginny and ask her for some advice.
Each year, the University of Idaho Women's Center gives out an award for gender activists in Ginny's honor. Our last clips are in celebration of the givers of birth and endless love and compassion. Mothers, of course.
In the book titled Mother Nature, there is a quote that says, "Working mothers are not new," end quote. Although something that is new is women that own their own businesses. For one to own a business, it takes hard work and responsibility. Although for women, it is a little bit more difficult to overcome the common myths that go along with it. There is a woman in my life that has overcome the myths and has been a successful business owner for about 20 years. That woman is my mother. My mom owns Rose's Catering, which specializes in Filipino and Oriental cuisine. For my mom's entire life, she has enjoyed cooking, learning how to cook rice at age 5, and picking up on other skills watching her grandmother in the kitchen. When she was in high school, she began making her own dishes and having her friends come over to test them. As a home ec teaching assistant, her teacher gave her the opportunity to demo authentic Filipino dishes for the class. It wasn't until my mom practically catered her own wedding that she thought, why not do this for others and make money doing it? So she started making flyers and going to neighborhoods, handing them out door to door. She says that being a woman never stopped her from thinking that owning a business would be more difficult, since a cooking business was something that women were stereotypically known for doing. But once she got into it, she said that the cooking part was easy. It was the business part that was a little harder and took a little bit more work. For me, growing up, it always felt like it was a family business. My dad and my older brother all helped out any time my mom had a catering. You always knew that whatever the weekend, your plans were to help out. No excuses. In our house that my mom did all the cooking, we had a very small kitchen, but somehow she did it, catering for as small as office Christmas parties to 200-plus guest weddings. She would do all the preparation that could be done the night before, staying up late if she had to, and then getting up early the day of to do all the other cooking for that day, which also meant we had to get up early to help out. One job I usually did was the fruit cutting. I remember once I had to cut something like 9 cantaloupes and 5 watermelons into these small cubes. I was only about 14, so this was something that felt endless to me. Anytime I would complain, my mom would always tell me I would make a great hostess for my own parties when I got older. She was just preparing me. Something that my mom is so good at is, besides her amazing cooking, the element of presentation. She does such a great job of looking at the whole picture. Not only does the food have to be good, but the tables have to be decorated to invite the guests to eat the food. The fruit trays are towers of spiraled melons and berries, and she always has a centerpiece for the table made out of flowers. She does it all, from delivering the food, setting up, as well as cleanup. Today, her expectations for this business have gone beyond what she ever imagined. Although there are more dreams and goals for Rose's Catering, she hopes that someday she can have 2 to 3 parties a week and 2 or 3 vans for transporting the food. Her passion is much stronger now than in the beginning because she can see endless ideas for dishes. As a pantry chef at a country club in Hayden, Idaho, my mom says she can create up to 15 different salad variations in a day, which is something she never thought could be possible. After having a successful business, something that my mom says remains difficult is the promotion and creating a menu to beat out competitors. Having a mother that owns her own business is all that I know because she's been doing it for my entire life and longer. To be able to look back at the success and the growth makes me respect my mom as a person as well as a business owner. Plus, she's only a phone call away if I need an idea for dinner, and she herself is an endless supply of recipes. She has taught me, whether she is aware of it or not, how to be a strong and independent person that I am today by watching her all of my life.
That's a great story, Brittany.
Thank you.
So you interviewed your mom for the story?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and just to make sure we give her a plug, because we're sure she's listening or at least going to listen.
Right.
She's Rose of Rose's Catering?
Yes.
Yeah, and where does she live?
She lives in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
Sandy Billings did an around town to ask people about their mothers.
Okay, she's like my best friend. I tell her everything, actually. I don't think I've not told her something, which she probably doesn't want to hear everything that I have to say, but I tell her everything. I feel like I'm a lot like her. I slowly realize as I'm getting older, like, how much more I'm like her, like, just little things, like how her things that she's anal about, I'm like, see them in myself, and I'm like, oh God, that's scary.
Tell me about your mother.
My mother makes really good lasagna.
My mom is a mother of 5 children. I'm the second oldest of that. 3 boys and a girl, and the two youngest are twins. And she's been married for 27 years, and she teaches alternative school for Pullman High. So she's really good with kids that come from broken homes, and she is loving, caring, open-hearted. She's always there for you when you need her. And she's probably my best friend, I'd have to say, which a lot of people, I guess, maybe can't say that about their moms, but I can say that about mine. So, yes, happy Mother's Day.
My mom lived to be 88 years old. I took care of her for 12 and a half years. She was wonderful. She just, we had good times together. We were always on the go, and she was not in very good health, but she did very well. She's a blessing of my life.
Tell me about your mother. It's for the Mother's Day show.
Oh, really? No. Tell her about your mother. Anything that you love about your mother or don't like.
I love how she always would say when I was little, "You're hungry? Eat a carrot."
Okay, then talk about your mother.
My mom grounded me all the time.
That's it.
And never let me do anything. She squashed my creativity.
And now it made me the woman I am today.
And, yeah. What'd she say?
She goes, "Yeah."
I have nothing to say about my mother. I have no mother.
That's what I have to say.
Our mother, let's see. Our mother, she lost her husband 10 years ago, and they were married for 50 years, and they were very, very much in love with each other. They held hands. They were their whole life to each other. And unfortunately, turn of events. My father was diagnosed with terminal cancer. 3 months later, they were in a severe car accident. My mother was hospitalized. And 3 months after that, my dad passed away from a massive heart attack. She's had to pick her whole life up and put it back together again and determine and discover who she really is, because she was always so lost in the love of our dad. She's got four of us kids. Grandchildren, and now she lives for us, and we can't imagine a day without her. She's in the hospital right now recovering, and we'll soon be home again, but we love her dearly, and we just wish her the very best. We love you, Mom. And this is from Dotes and
Tertur.
Love you, Wong.
Well, I'm Karen Stetzelberger, and I wouldn't trade my mom for the world.
Yeah, I love it. And my name is Justin Ruggles, and my mom's pretty much the coolest person in the world. That's pretty much explains it all.
Well, she's a nice lady.
Tell me about your mom.
I remember telling my mom that I thought it was so cool that I used to be in her belly, and now we're like best friends.
I remember telling you that. That's insane.
We don't really have, you know, the heirloom things, but we do have a pie crust recipe.
Oh.
And Grandma taught Mom how to make it. My mom taught me how to make it, so that's why we all know how to make such wicked pie crust. So, yeah.
So what's the secret?
I'm not going to tell you. Well, she's a nice lady.
Tell me about your mom.
I remember telling my mom that I thought it was so cool that I used to be in her belly, and now we're like best friends.
I remember telling you that. That's insane.
We don't really have, you know, the heirloom things, but we do have a pie crust recipe.
Oh.
And Grandma taught Mom how to make it. My mom taught me how to make it, so that's why we all know how to make such wicked pie crust. So, yeah.
So what's the secret?
I'm not going to tell you.
My mother is a lot more like, or I'm a lot more like her than I want to admit, or than I used to want to admit. she's really like the earth mom, like down to earth. And I used to, when I was little, I always wanted a mom who carried a purse with lipstick and chewing gum in it and wore high heels, and because all my friends would play dress up, you know, in their mom's dresses and their mom's like high heel shoes, and my mom didn't have any dresses or high heel shoes. She wears mascara for real fancy occasions, and then she forgets and wipes it all over her face, and she never dyed her hair ever. Like, it's getting pretty silverish now, and yeah, I used to think she was so old-fashioned, and you know, I just wanted like a modern-looking, fancy mom, and now I think it's pretty cool. My mom owns 2 pair of socks. She's always barefoot, always. She only wears, like, socks when she has to wear shoes. She's real sensitive. She cries for everything. And I'm kind of not really like that, but, like, if my mom and I, if we sit down and watch TV, we can turn something on and it's a movie that we've never seen. Like, we don't know what the plot is or anything. Someone on the TV starts crying, we start crying too, like that. And, yeah, we have no idea what the movie's about or why they're crying, but we'll just cry, too, because, I don't know, my dad's like, my sister's like my dad, and I'm like my mother.
I'll leave you with a song called Code of Kindness.
To wave when we'd pass along our road. Everyone seemed to know each other. Everybody knew the code of kindness to our neighbors, glad to help each other out. Just a smile and a wave always left you with no doubt.
Listen to past shows or podcast this show, or sign up for an electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and heard on Boise Community Radio at radioboise.org, and on other stations around the country. This show is produced by Annamaria Roque and Sandy Billings. Music is by Piano Chocolate and Linda Lou Michael and Michael Reich. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation, and Sandy Billings is the executive producer. For Yin Radio, I'm Annamaria Roque. Thank you for joining me.